Welcome to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast, this time focused on financial reporting for cross-border SPAC transactions. Listen to KPMG professionals discuss key points on these complicated areas.
Hello, I'm Karen Silverman, a partner at KPMG, and in this podcast, I'm visiting with a fellow partner in the firm's Department of Professional Practice, Holger Erkinger. I'm really excited for today's episode where we're going to talk about cross-border SPAC transactions and the related financial reporting and disclosure requirements. I want to start off today by giving you a bit of an introduction before we let Holger dive into the details. Over the past 18 months, there's been an explosion of special purpose acquisition companies, commonly known as SPACs, on Wall Street. In 2020, there were approximately 250 SPAC IPOs, raising an aggregate of approximately $80 billion. The average size of a single SPAC IPO was approximately $340 million of capital raising. Based on current market data, this trend appears to be continuing in the early part of 2021. SPACs, which occasionally and colloquially can be referred to as blank check companies, are usually established as Delaware corporations, but some SPACs have been formed in foreign jurisdictions, such as the Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, or the Marshall Islands, and the target operating companies they are seeking to acquire are not limited to companies based in the U.S., but the targets could be incorporated in any jurisdiction anywhere across the globe. There are extensive and comprehensive disclosure and financial reporting requirements which go along with SPAC transactions, and generally there is also an avalanche of financial accounting and reporting issues that need to be sorted out, starting with the SPAC creation, throughout the so-called de-SPAC process, and when the ultimate registrant becomes a U.S. issuer, with ongoing filing and reporting requirements under the U.S. Exchange Act. Our focus today will highlight some of the challenges which arise in conjunction with cross-border SPAC transactions, including SEC filings, financial reporting, and accounting ramifications. Okay, so Holger, thanks for joining us today. With that as a very general background, can you start us off by giving us some more specifics about SPACs before we move into details on the cross-border aspects?
Yeah, thank you very much, Karen. And let me start slow and clarify a few key aspects in regards to SPAC transactions in order to get everyone level set. And following up on a point you just made, Karen, the significant increase of SPAC IPOs probably is the outcome of a confluence of factors, including the availability of unspent committed capital or dry powder of investment companies and private equity funds, the low interest rate environment, as well as a systemic extension of the business models of the alternative investment industry into SPAC deal making or sponsoring. So now, and first of all, SPACs are publicly traded entities created for the sole purpose of raising capital in order to acquire one or more operating companies, and as such are sometimes referred to as blank check companies, as you mentioned already, Karen. And a SPAC's life cycle begins with its initial formation, followed by its IPO, its search for a target operating company to be acquired, a shareholder merger vote, and closing of the acquisition. And the SPAC process differs from of a traditional IPO in that the target operating company, which eventually becomes the public company post-acquisition, is not involved in the formation of the SPAC or the IPO phases. SPACs are listed either at NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, yet given the recent focus on technology operating companies, a vast majority are listed at NASDAQ. The SPAC sponsors as founding investors are initiating and establishing a SPAC and then lead the SPAC process and presumably have the expertise to identify target operating companies and to complete acquisitions. Certainly very important SPAC transactions are subject to regulatory oversight by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, and there are comprehensive filing, reporting, and disclosure requirements, as you mentioned, Karen, are in conjunction with executing transactions involving SPACs, which are basically the same as for traditional IPOs. Also, and for example, the Division of Corporation Finance of the SEC issued in December of 2020 disclosure guidance on SPACs, providing their views about certain disclosures and other securities law obligations in connection with SPAC IPOs and subsequent business combination transactions. And these disclosures include information about the nature of the economic interests of the SPAC sponsors, directors and officers, and their affiliates, so that public investors understand their financial incentives and compensation arrangements and their interconnections, as well as potential conflicts of interests. From the perspective of the shareholders and management of the operating company, being acquired by a SPAC gives them the opportunity to either become public or to exit the operating company.
Great. Thanks for all that background, Holger. I think that was a good level set for all of us. So from a sequencing of events perspective, and at a high level, walk us through what exactly happens in a SPAC transaction.
Karen, actually, every SPAC transaction has its own specific fact pattern and nuances. Yet to simplify what happens, let me go over some basic steps, which are usually executed in a sequential order. First, a SPAC is initially capitalized by sponsors with nominal capital to fund its formation and offering costs in exchange for founder shares. The typical sponsors include investment companies and asset managers, including private equity and hedge funds. Then the next step is that the SPAC is filing a registration statement with the SEC to conduct its IPO, and then the IPO proceeds from those new public shareholders are placed into a trust or escrow account and are to be used to acquire a target operating company. And then the SPAC identifies a privately held target operating company as a potential acquisition target. And then the execution of the acquisition of this operating company by the SPAC prerequisites shareholders' approval. And this operating company could be a US target, or it could be a foreign target outside the United States, and as such be a cross-border SPAC transaction. Also, I would like to mention that in addition to the sponsors and the IPO shareholders, the prior shareholders of the operating company target usually also receive an equity interest in the SPAC. In addition, there are so-called PIPE investors, and PIPE stands for Private Investment in Public Entity, which are investors which are lined up for the purpose of providing additional funding as needed for acquiring the operating company under so-called backstop arrangements. And then these PIPE investors could or could not be affiliated with a sponsor or could be other institutional investors. Then the SPAC and the operating company eventually will become a merged combined entity, which then will be the publicly traded registrant following the so-called de-SPAC process. And this transaction is often structured as a reverse merger in which the operating company merges with and into the SPAC or a subsidiary of the SPAC. And while there are various ways to structure the initial business combination and merger, the combined entity eventually emerging is the publicly traded company going forward and carries on the target operating company's business. The board of director then usually includes the SPAC sponsors or their representatives, in addition to directors appointed by the sellers of the operating company. And certainly, and again, every SPAC transaction might contain a variety of further complexities, permutations, and variations, which then are driving or determining all the implications in regards to financial reporting and disclosures, financial accounting and taxation, and the corresponding key impacts are inextricably linked to the corporate governance structure and ownership allocation over the ultimate registrant reporting entity.
Okay, Holger, that's given us a sense of how these SPAC transactions are executed and who the key players are. Now, let's talk about some of the specific financial reporting and SEC filing requirements to consider here.
First of all, Karen, the SPACs incorporation documents or equity agreements typically require the SPACs public shareholders to vote on the acquisition transaction. And this triggers regulatory filings with the SEC pre-merger with various financial reporting consequences for the target and comprehensive required disclosures. Before consummating the merger, the SPAC files with the SEC either a proxy statement on Schedule 14A under the Securities Act of 1934, or a combined proxy and registration statement on SEC Form S-4 or F-4, which includes matters seeking shareholder approval, as well as the target's historical financial statements, management's discussion and analysis, and also pro forma financial information showing the effect of the merger from the perspective of the SPAC. The target's historical financial statements must comply with SEC rules and regulations, including SEC Regulation SX and the SEC staff accounting bulletins, which govern presentation and disclosures in the financial statements. Also, they must include 2 or 3 years of operations and must be audited under PCAOB auditing standards. The target may provide 2 years of audited financial statements rather than 3 if it would qualify as a smaller reporting company, or if the SPAC is an emerging growth company, the SPAC has not yet filed its first 10K, and the target company also would qualify as an emerging growth company if it were conducting its own IPO of common equity securities. Then, after the transaction closes, a Form 8K, referred to as a Super 8K or Super 20F, needs to be filed with the SEC. The Super 8K includes all information that would have been required if the target were filing an initial registration statement on SEC Form 10, and this includes, among other information, the target's historical financial statements prepared under U.S. GAAP, unless the post-merger registrant meets the definition of a foreign private issuer. The financial reporting requirements pre- and post-merger differ depending on whether the registrant qualifies as a U.S. domestic registrant or as a foreign private issuer. After completing the SPAC merger, situations may arise where the post-merger and ultimate registrants qualifies as a foreign private issuer.
Thanks again, Holger. That was a lot of information. And as you said earlier, the filing, disclosure, and reporting requirements are clearly very comprehensive. You just mentioned the term foreign private issuer, or FPI. Could you please clarify what that means in the context of a cross-border SPAC deal?
Yes, sure, Karen. And the exact definition is contained in Rule 3B4 under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Yet in general, an FPI is a foreign company which is legally incorporated outside the United States and does not have more than 50% of the outstanding voting securities owned by U.S. residents, and either the majority of the executive officers or directors are not U.S. citizens, or not more than 50% of the assets of the issuer are located in the United States. Foreign private issuers benefit from reduced reporting obligations compared to U.S. domestic registrants, including foreign private issuers can elect to prepare IFRS financial statements for purposes of their SEC filings. They are not required to file quarterly reports on Form 10Q or current reports on Form 8K. The SEC's proxy statement disclosure requirements and proxy solicitation rules do not apply to FPIs. FPIs are using a Form 20F as their annual report, which has to be filed within 4 months after the end of the fiscal year, and also financial statements prepared by foreign private issuers in general go stale later than those prepared by U.S. domestic registrants.
Huh, that's really interesting. So it appears that the distinction as to whether or not a U.S. registrant reports as a domestic issuer versus an FPI has many financial reporting and disclosure implications and consequences. Could you explore a bit more some of the pre- and post-merger financial reporting issues that may arise when Target is a foreign operating company?
Oh, absolutely. So U.S. domiciled SPACs are by definition U.S. domestic registrants and as such U.S. GAAP financial statement preparers. The key question in a merger between a U.S. domiciled SPAC and a foreign target is whether the foreign target's financial statements need to be prepared in accordance with US GAAP or IFRS, for which reporting periods, and also at what point in time. And this question comes up because post-merger, the target company, rather than the SPAC, will be considered the predecessor to the post-merger registrant as defined and contemplated by SEC Regulation C, Rule 405. When the proxy registration statement is filed, the merger has not yet occurred and may not occur at all if the SPAC shareholders are not approving it. Therefore, the target's financial statements can be presented under IFRS in the proxy registration statement. However, the Article 11 pro formas under the SEC requirements included in the proxy or registration statement still require presentation under US GAAP. Because the target operating company will be considered the predecessor, its financial statements will become the primary financial statements of the US domestic registrant. And as a result, the financial statements of the target company included in the Super 8K generally need to be prepared using US GAAP unless the ultimate registrant is meeting the definition of a foreign private issuer. Additionally, the financial statements of the target operating company included in the proxy registration statement must be audited under PCAOB auditing standards and by considering PCAOB and SEC independence requirements. And oftentimes, those financial statements of foreign target companies have been audited, but they have been audited under other auditing standards, such as, for example, International Standards on Auditing, or ISAs, which are not accepted for SEC or US filing purposes.
Thanks so much, Holger. So what would happen if, say, the SPAC is a foreign domiciled company with predominantly US shareholders?
This is a very good question, Karen. And in case there are predominantly US shareholders, the SPAC would report to the SEC as a US domestic registrant pre-merger. However, after the merger with the operating company target, the post-merger registrant may be able to qualify as a foreign private issuer, and as a result of the shareholder composition and or its foreign nexus. The foreign private issuer status then would allow the foreign target company to use IFRS in its financial statements included in the proxy and registration statement, in the Super 8K or Super 20F, and for its ongoing reporting requirements under the 1934 Exchange Act. Also, the post-merger registrant would benefit from reduced financial reporting obligations that come along with foreign private issuer status, and as mentioned already earlier. And this outcome may be desirable if the foreign target itself is already an IFRS reporting entity and for other reasons by considering certain reliefs provided to foreign private issuers, registrants, as mentioned earlier.
Okay, Holger, thanks. So in a cross-border SPAC transaction, what are the possible outcomes after the de-SPAC process is completed and the ultimate registrant has emerged? What would the ongoing SEC filing change act?
Karen, generally, in a cross-border SPAC transaction, there could be four potential outcomes. Number one would be that the SPAC and the ultimate registrant, which acquired the foreign operating target company, will be a US domestic registrant, which means they would be preparing historical US GAAP financial statements for the Super 8K, filing after the close of the transaction, and also the post-merger registrant would continue to report under US GAAP and as a US domestic issuer. So that's outcome number one. Outcome number two could be that a SPAC, which is domiciled outside the United States in any foreign jurisdiction, which acquired a foreign operating company target, could qualify as a foreign private issuer, assuming the other criteria I had mentioned before also are met. And then that would enable it to file IFRS financial statements post-closing and on an ongoing basis, and that company then also could avail itself of the other financial reporting and disclosure reliefs available for foreign private issuers. The third potential outcome could be that in addition to the US-based SPAC, which is a US registrant, and the foreign operating company, there will be a new co or new holding company inserted in addition, incorporated and based outside the US, that then would become the ultimate registrant following the de-SPAC process and qualify for foreign private issuer status after the transaction closes. And likewise, that registrant then would be able to file IFRS financial statements post-closing and on an ongoing basis and could avail itself of the other financial reporting and disclosure reliefs. And potential outcome number four could be that a US domiciled SPAC could undergo a corporate inversion in a jurisdiction outside the United States, and assuming the other FPI criteria are met, also would no longer be a US domestic registrant, and likewise then could elect to file and provide disclosures under the foreign private issuer reporting regime as contemplated by the SEC rules.
Great. That's definitely a helpful summary of potential scenarios for a cross-border SPAC transaction. So one last question for today. We've talked about financial reporting, but could you take us through some accounting matters and issues you've been seeing involving cross-border SPAC transactions?
Oh, happy to, Karen. And as you have mentioned in your introduction, there is an avalanche of financial accounting issues, which we have been seeing, and also certainly given that each SPAC transaction has its own specifics and permutations, the financial accounting implications can be wide-ranging and even slight nuances in the contractual arrangements or corporate governance variations could lead to significant accounting ramifications and differences. Nevertheless, let me try to touch on a few selected key accounting matters, and starting with those at the level of the ultimate registrant that is emerging following the de-SPAC process. So first and foremost, the accounting for the acquisition or reverse acquisition or recapitalization, including the determination of the predecessor under the SEC rules, and accordingly, any conclusion about the accounting prerequisites an exact understanding of the ownership structure before IPO, after IPO, and after acquisition of the operating company by the SPAC, including to what extent cash was involved versus to what extent it involved an exchange of shares or a combination of cash and shares. That's one in order to address the accounting for the acquisition, reverse acquisition, or recapitalization. Secondly, the accounting for financial instruments issued by the registrant, which includes classification as either financial liability or equity, for example, for preferred shares or warrants being issued by the registrant, and also, very important, the corresponding valuation matters. Third, potential employee benefit and share-based payment arrangement accounting matters are quite prevalent and also include debt versus equity classification aspects at the registrant reporting entity level. Four, and very specific to cross-border transactions, potential first time of IFRS adoption implications, including, for example, the interplay for situations involving combined and carve-out financial statements for acquired foreign businesses. And five, various presentation issues, including the earnings per share or EPS requirements and implications related to capital restructuring. At the level of the reporting entity sponsor, so if we look to the sponsor's financial statements, then certainly the accounting for the equity or other financial interests the sponsor has in the SPAC and in the ultimate registrant, as for example, accounting questions around the equity method of accounting or as financial assets, and also again related valuation issues, including for warrants or other potential derivative financial instruments, which are a component of the SPAC transaction. And secondly, at the level of the sponsor, the accounting for potential future funding obligations all related party transactions, including all their presentation and disclosure requirements.
That's very interesting. Thank you so much, Holger, for joining this podcast today. This is a very hot topic in the market, and I know that I have a much better appreciation of the challenges associated with cross-border SPAC transactions. You've discussed a variety of complexities involved when a foreign operating company is the target in a SPAC transaction. And I think what I took away from this discussion is that advance planning is critical. Early identification of issues and complexities and consultation with a company's SEC counsel and likely their auditors seems to be very important for companies in the process. I really appreciate your thoughtful commentary, Holger, and I certainly enjoyed learning more about this topic.
Thanks, Karen. Happy to be here.
Great. If our listeners would like more information on SPAC transactions, broadly speaking, we have a fantastic website called the KPMG SPAC Intel Hub, and it has a whole variety of resources available. I'd certainly encourage you to take a look. Holger, thanks again for your insights and your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. For more information on cross-border SPAC transactions, please go to our website, frv.kpmg.us. Stay safe and stay tuned for more on this important topic.